for years and has become a personal friend of mine. We've shared in step studies together over the years, and he's come a long way. And I'd like to welcome Nick T.
I'm a recovering addict. My name is Nick. And I'd like to ask you to help me with a serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. The reason why I've done that is that I always find that God helps me in times of needs, and I need a little strength because I'm a little nervous. And that usually works. You know, that usually makes me feel better. And it strengthens my faith. As I said, I'm a recovering addict. My name is Nick, and I belong to the Road to Recovery at Eglinton and Dufferin in the Toronto city, in the city of Toronto. My clean date is April the 13th, 1991. And the reason why I said those two things is because that's very important to me. You know, I heard at a convention one time, an old timer said that, you know, if you don't know your clean date, or if you don't remember your clean date, you don't have one, you know. So I must remember when I got clean. I was a trusted member, a friend of mine, Fran, on the programming committee, had asked me if I would be interested in speaking and at this convention about a month ago. And I was really, I had a lot on my plate. I was going to school every time, and I was into my exams, into my final exams, and I was working part-time in the field of recovery, and I was getting my six-year-old son. And I really said, well, I haven't even submitted a tape, you know. She says, well, that's okay. She says, you know, we, you know, give it a try because, well, I said, okay. I says, I'm not going to commit myself, but I said, I'll see what I can do, you know. And I says, what am I going to be speaking on? And she said to me at the time, she says, well, I know what you'll be good in. She said, you'll be good in jails and institutions, you know. And I thought to myself, wow. I said, geez. I said, I said, that's right up my alley, you see, because I spent 12 years of my 30-year addiction in jails and institutions. So I said to Fran, I says, well, I says, maybe it's more of a yes than a no. I'll speak on that topic. But as it turned out, there's been a few changes. The programming people have made a few changes, and they've asked me to speak on gratitude. And you see, that's God, how God works in my life today. How can I go wrong about speaking about gratitude? You know? So instead of entertaining you with you know, all the jails and institution stuff and all the war stories and stuff like that, I might touch on it. Maybe a little bit later on in my experience, strength, and hope. I'm going to try to speak on gratitude. You know, it's important for me to tell you where I come from. You know, I come around this room. I stumbled upon these rooms a little over 4 years ago, and I didn't come into these rooms brimming with love and understanding. And I came into these rooms because I had nowhere else to go. I was a very, very sick individual, emotionally, physically, and spiritually. And I came into his room brimming with hate, with remorse, and with anger. And it's not like that today. I don't feel those things today. I got, you know, I came to this, the program of Narcotics Anonymous from a jail cell. You know, I found myself charged with what I thought I was good at, trafficking narcotics, and then in a span of 30 years, I only got pinched twice. You know, so that's not really too bad. You know, and but nevertheless, it happened again. You know, the first time it cost me 8.5 years of my life. The second time, I didn't do too bad, and I'm thankful to the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous because this is why I'm standing here today. You see, I didn't come around here to get clean. I came around here to go to a treatment center, to go in front of a judge, to say, Your Honor, here's what you see today, and this is how much I've cleaned up, and, you know, give me whatever you're going to give me, and that's it, you know. And but it didn't work that way, you know. Something happened along the way, and I got clean, you know. And thanks to God and to the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, and thanks to you people, and thanks to my sponsor, I've stayed clean right from that first day. I was locked up for about 6 months, and I couldn't get out. My lawyer was saying, please do something. You're 45 years old and, you know, give it up. She says, aren't you tired? Give it up. You're going to die, Nick. You know, she's kept me out of jail the last 10, 15 years. And I said, well, how do I do that? You know, and she said, well, we'll send you to treatment. I know some people that might be able to help you, you know. And I was a mess. You know, I would have these interviews with my lawyer. In these little cells, you know, that they would lock you up with your lawyer there. And I would overdose on her, you know, and I would take stuff, you know. And then by the time I got to the interview room, I would just go under on her, you know. And she couldn't believe it, you know. The first time that happened, she got scared. She started screaming, of course. The custodians came over there and opened it up, and he says, well, he does that all the time, you know. I was going to court, and I don't remember going to court. I would wake up in a hole, you know, 4 or 5 days later. And they told me, oh, you've been to court, and you've got a remand, and you're supposed to go next week. And I didn't know. I didn't know anything about it, you know. So she planted the seed, you know. She planted the seed. And she says, we're going to go in front of a judge, and the chances are that he might grant you bail, but one of those conditions of the bail is that you go to treatment. And I said, okay, you know, let's go for it. I couldn't get out any other way, you know. And so she did see a friend of mine that was working or operating Anonymous Health Consultants. And they come up with a brilliant idea that they were going to send me to London, England for treatment. And I says, well, let's go for it. You know, it's London, England. I've never been to London, England. And okay, so I went and got cleaned up. And on the first trip to London, England, I was doing it for the judge. I was doing it for the lawyer. I was doing it for everybody else. I was doing it for my ex-wife, my ex-common law partner. But I wasn't doing it for myself. I was just going to be, you know, put on one of the facade and go there, get cleaned up, and take it from there. So needless to say, after 3 days in the treatment center in London, England, I just went out. I just went out with three other recovering addicts, and I'm a dope fiend, and I know where the dope is. And I know other dope fiends, no matter where I go. And I just went and got it. And I just went and got it, and I put it in me. Within 3 days, of being in the city that I never been before in my life, 6,000 miles away, you know. And I've been a liar and a cheat, and I continued to lie and cheat. And when I come back to the treatment center, we were in group, and they were accusing me of being high. And I would say, who, me? And I was falling off the chair. They said, yes, you, and your old partner there too, right? And she would go, who, me? And boom, off the chair, right? So they called me in the office, and they said, well, I don't think that you're ready for this, so we're going to send you back. And I said, send me back? How can you do that, you know? Right away, everything started to catch up to me. Here goes my bail condition. My brother had put up a $20,000 bond and all that stuff, and I was surely to go back to jail. And I said, don't you understand that you can't send me back, you know? And but the guy that ran the place, the head psychiatrist, said to me in a very British accent, I shall see you in perhaps 3 months. And I was a conniver. I got on my knees and I begged, and I said, take my a sample every day, you know, do whatever you want, but let me stay. And he says, no, I shall see you later. And they put me on a plane, and they shipped me back to Toronto. And I'm really grateful for I didn't know anything about relapses then, you know. But now I understand that after 3 days or 4 days being clean, that was my first relapse. I didn't understand it then, but I understand it today. And today I'm very, very grateful for that relapse, because if it wasn't for that relapse, chances are that I won't be standing here today. And something changed. Of course, I went through the airport in London, and I used to be a thief, and I boosted in the airport of London. I got nice sweaters waiting for the connecting flight, and that's all I knew how to do. That was my life, all my life. I've been a liar, I've been a cheat, I've been a mooch, I've been a pimp, and I'm good sometimes at what I do, you know. I come back to Toronto, and I was full of guilt and shame. I went back to the to Anonymous Health Consultants, and I had aftercare. And I think that that's probably the time that God really started to work into my life, because I really wanted to crawl into a hole. I wanted to crawl into a hole and die, you know. But people around Anonymous Health Consultants kept on encouraging me, you know. And they kept on hugging me, and they kept on telling me to come back, and they kept on telling me that it was okay, and they kept on telling me that we're trying, we'll try another treatment center, we'll send you someplace else, we'll try London again, we'll try anything, but just keep coming around, you know, keep coming around, and don't use. And on the other hand, I had guys that were coming to me with my drug of choice. And I would go out and I would go and use with them. But then somehow I always went back. I always went back to the aftercare. And particularly my friend that is no longer with us today, Dominic, he was very kind and supportive and understanding. You see, because there's no parallel when an addict helps another addict, and he had been an addict himself, and he knew what I was going through, and he never said to me, "Don't come back here anymore, you know, come on in, talk, sit down, do this, do that," and I did. We wrote a letter to Chelsea Charter Medical, and I wouldn't believe it, one day we get a response, and they were willing to take me back at the same place. And I couldn't believe it, but I also had this feeling, though, that something was beginning to work in my life. And I remember clearly this day that a couple of friends of mine from my past came in to the aftercare, and they got me out of there, and they opened this package and they put it right in front of me, and you know, it was quite a bit there, and they said, "Come on, let's go." And I looked, and I said, no thanks. And they couldn't believe it. They couldn't. I said no to my drug of choice for the very first time in my life, ever. And I think that was a spiritual awakening for me. You know, I think probably that was my very first spiritual awakening, because it's very hard for me to say no to my drug of choice. I have never said no to my drug of choice up until that day. In fact, I used to go to any extent to get that stuff and to do what I had to do with it, and then put it in my lungs. And they couldn't understand, you know, they couldn't understand. And then they walked away. They says, "Well, we'll meet you at this restaurant." And I you know, I says, "Yeah, okay, we'll meet you there." But I double-doored them. I never showed up, you know. And the president of Anonymous Health Consultants said to me that you're going back there tomorrow. And they drove me to the airport the following day, and I got on the plane. And for some reason, this time, I was doing it for me. I just had this feeling that, you know what, I wanted to go back to this place. You see, I got a little sniff there the first couple of days, the 3 days that I was there. They were talking about little slogans, and they were talking about steps, and they were talking about this and that, and talking about ourselves, and then we would sit in these circles, you know, and have a little bit of therapy, you know. So 3 or 4 days wasn't very much, but I got a good sense of smell, you know, and I smelled something good, you know. And so I went back to the same treatment center that had just thrown me out a couple of weeks prior. And this time, going back, I didn't drink on the plane. I didn't take any Valiums. I didn't take any Tylenol 3s. I didn't take any Percodons. I didn't take none of that drug stuff, you know. and which I had done the first time. And when I got there, the man that said to me, "I'll see you in 3 months," was waiting for me with open arms, you know. And somehow I think fate had just started to tell me that, you know what, if I didn't pick up on a daily basis, you know, that maybe a 45-year-old convict, ex-convict like myself, would maybe have a chance in life, you know. And I started to see this, you know, and a week went by, and 2 weeks went by, and I really got into the treatment. And they asked me after 3 weeks to do my life story, you know. And I says, "Oh boy, this is," and they asked me to share it in therapy. And so I started to do this, and I did. I would normally balk at stuff like that, you know. But I patiently sat in my room, and you know, I wrote all this stuff. I would stay up till 2 or 3 in the morning, and I wrote my first life story, you know. And I have all that stuff today. I still have that initial. And what they were asking me to do was to do a fourth and fifth step, you know. And I didn't understand that at the time, you know. But that's exactly what I did. You know, I wrote my fourth step on 32 pages, double side, you know. And then I went into treatment, and I shared it with everybody there. And they gave me the assets, and they gave me the blocks, you know. And it was good, you know, it was good, because I started to really tell myself who I was. And at the same time, I was telling other people what I was all about, you know. And a lot of anger come up, you know. A lot of insecurity come up. A lot of hate, you know. I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I'm the youngest of 8 siblings. I was born in Italy, and we came to this country when I was about 12 years old. My mother died when I was 8, and my father died shortly after that, a couple years after, when I was 10. And I grew up with a lot of guilt and shame, because I thought my mother had kidney failure, and I felt that she had died because she had given birth to me at you know, in the latter stage of her life. She was about 43, 44, I guess. And I grew up with that not belonging feelings all the time, you know. And I had a milk mother that was nursing me at the time that my mother was ill, you know. And my brothers and sister would always tease me when I got a little older about my other mother. And, you know, and I grew up with that. I thought that the lady that nursed me was my real mother, you know. And when I started to go to school, when I was 5 or 6 years old, I would pass through these streets in an old town in southern Italy, and she would just sweep me off my feet into the house, and she would shower me with candies and treats and chocolates, and then she would send me off to school with her little boy, you know, because we were born around the same time. So I always grew up with the feeling that I didn't belong with my family, that my real mother wasn't my mother. It was the other lady that was my mother. And I grew up resentful. I felt rejected. I felt anger, although I couldn't really know what anger was at an age of 10, 12 years old. But it started to manifest itself when I came to this country. My dad had passed away before we came here, and that was another big shocking loss to me. I was devastated. I loved my father. I adored my father. He would take me anywhere when I was a little boy. He would shower me that affection. I was always the one that would go on the main horse, you know, when he would go out and look after the. He was a landowner, you know, and fairly wealthy. And he would go and overlook the workers, and I would go with him, you know. And then all of a sudden, that was just, you know, it was just taken away from me. And My anger started to manifest itself when I reached the streets of Toronto. I took to the streets right away. I was 13 years old, and I joined gangs around College and Ossington, Bathurst and Queen, ethnic areas. And I went to school till grade 8, and then I dropped out, and then I got in trouble. I went through the 311 system. I got sent to a place called the Working Boys Home. And I was very, very angry, very, very... The cops were at my door all the time, every day, and knocking, B&E's, violence at a very early age, you know, very violent. And that's the way that I grew up, you know. I sort of, you know, straightened out a little bit, and I went to high school, and I managed to get a couple of years high school under my belt. And then I decided that really school is not what I wanted to do, so I went out and got a job, and I went to work for the Globe and Mail. And I served an apprenticeship there with them for 5 years, and I'm a linotype operator by trade. It's the longest job that I ever had working at the Globe. I think I was there about 6.5 to 7 years. And but after that, I was still looking at what the guys around the corner were doing, you know, the pool halls and driving these fast cars, you know, Cadillacs and Mustangs and or big cars and fast cars. And that's really what I wanted to be, you know. I didn't want to be a printer. I didn't want to go and work for $350, $400 a week. And in those days, that was a lot of money. I'm talking about 1964, 1965, you know. I wanted the easy life. I wanted to become like my role models. And I had role models that hung around at certain corners, you know. And that's really what I wanted to do. And I did that. I started, you know, I'm a product of the 60s. So I did all the things that as young guys did in the 60s. You know, I started with drugs. And I tried all kinds of drugs. And eventually I got fired from my job. I got caught with some marijuana, and I was right in the front page of the Globe and Mail. And so they called me in the office, and my production manager says, "Well," and I said, "Well," he says, "Well, I think you're in trouble here." And I says, "Well, anyway," he gave me about 6 months and told me to start looking for other work. And that was okay with me because I didn't want to work, period. So I said, "Well, that's okay. I'll see you later." And I went to hang around the pool hall. And I started to pimp at a very early age. Now I was 19 years old. And then I got tired of doing that for a while. And I started to experiment with hard drugs, you know. And I always lived the double life, you know. I didn't want my family to know what I was really doing. And so I thought, well, you know what, the best thing for me to cure that is go for a geographical cure, you know. So I decided to move to Vancouver in 1968. And someone I knew gave me this package and said, "Here it is, go do what you got to do." And I did that. And I went out there and I started to traffic, you know. But I was scared of this stuff. I was really, really scared of this stuff. I never touched it, you know. Then I met a young lady out there, and for the very first time, I touched it. And what a feeling, you know. There it goes. All my insecurity were gone away. I belonged. I could do anything I wanted. And before long, I was wired pretty good, you know. And I tried. You know, I didn't understand what recovery was in those years, but I tried to quit. I mean, I knew that I was in trouble right off the hop when I couldn't stop on my own, you know. So I went on a methadone clinic in 1970 in Vancouver. And over the years, I thought that that was the way that I could just, you know, try to stop. It is substitute one drug with another. But even then, the end results were always the same, excuse me, for me. There were jails and institutions. And I would stay out 6 months, a year or so, and then I would get caught doing something. And I would end up back in jail. And I hit bottom pretty fast. I had boats. I had a house in Vancouver. I had a lovely wife. And she was an addict. And we used to take trips to Hawaii and trips to San Francisco. And I've traveled all the way through the United States and the Western Coast. But 2 years after that, I found myself at the corner of Pembroke and Dundas, which is the tenderloin of the city of Toronto, in very bad shape. You know, I found myself with my face in the soup, and full of bombers, and all you know, drugged up, and I become a garbage can. I didn't care what it was. You had it, and I did it, and I got it into me, and it didn't matter what it was. So that's the furs and the fast cars, and everything was gone away. And the wife had gone away to the penitentiary herself after getting caught for 6 years, and my time was coming. So that was my first bottom. And I'm not going to entertain you with that. I can tell you only that my life was very violent. It was a very, very violent existence. Violence became a way of life for me. It was a survival skill. And because of that violence, it's probably one reason that I'm here today, because I learned very quickly how to survive. I survived in maximum and medium penitentiary system, and it's a very, very violent world in there, environment, you know. But I am the kind of guy that I could adapt, you know, and I adapted pretty well. And life went on like that, you know. I like to talk about recovery a little bit, because that's more important to me today than my past. I just wanted to touch a little bit on my past so that you would know what some of my experiences of strength. And I'm going to talk about my hopes right now. ever since I've come around, I got a home group, Road to Recovery. After 3 months, they were telling me, go to 90 meetings in 90 days. Get a sponsor. Get a home group. Don't pick up. Call people. Share when you hurt. Tell people you're hurting. And these were suggestions that are freely given to us when we come around to the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. And I'm very grateful that I started to pay attention to those suggestions, you know, because I wanted this thing to work. You see, all of a sudden, I didn't want to commit suicide anymore. I didn't want to hurt anybody anymore. I didn't want to raise a hand against anyone anymore. I didn't want to do violence against myself or anyone else, anybody else anymore. And I wanted to live. I wanted to live. And I did all those things. I got a sponsor. I got a home group, and I did two, sometimes three meetings a day. And I went to a lot of meetings. And I didn't pick up on a daily basis. I went to live in a recovery home. You know, and it's a three-quarter house, and you know what? I never in my life have liked living with anybody else in halfway homes, or any time that I ended up going to a halfway home before this, I would always get sent back to the pen, to the penitentiary, and I knew that I had to work on stuff like that. I wanted to tackle the problem at the root, and I went to live. I went to live in St. Vincent de Paul Recovery Home, For the first 3 months, I lived upstairs on the third floor in a sweltering heat, sharing a room with somebody else. But that was okay, because I started to understand that if I wanted to stay clean, I had to go to any length to get it, you know. And I knew, deep in my heart, I knew that I didn't always have to sleep in the third floor room, sharing with another addict, or with another person for that matter. And that's exactly what happened. After 3 months, I got my own room. And I moved down to the second floor. And I went to a lot of meetings. And I learned how to live because I don't know how to live, you know. I'm good at lying and cheating and stealing and thieving and mooching, but I really don't know how to live with other human beings. And I had to learn all this, you know. I felt okay in those big places that I had wire fences all the way around. I never had any problem there. I fit it in like you know, I was there and it was okay. But that's not, you know, what the problem was here. I had to tackle the problem at the root. And talking about gratitude, am I ever grateful? Am I ever thankful for the society that took me in? And that's exactly what they done. They took me in, you know, because I had nowhere else to go. I mean, here's a guy that had about 30 days, 35 days clean, and I couldn't live at home anymore. I couldn't live with my partner's ex-partner's apartment because they were all using over there, you know. So they took me in, you know. They took me in, and I went to live there, and I did the do things. I started to go to meetings every day. I got a sponsor, got a home group, and I started to share, and I started to get better. And I had bad days and good days. We all go through the waves of recovery. I remember 9 months, I wanted to commit suicide. I wanted to kill myself because I started to do some writing and all the stuff that was coming out. I really didn't want to look at it. I didn't want to address it. I didn't want to look at it. I didn't want anything to do with it at all. And I'm grateful that I had a good sponsor, you know, because I went to my sponsor and I said, this is exactly what I want to do. And this is exactly what I'm going to do. And he loved me and he cared for me and he took me by the hand. He used to take me to meetings, you know, literally just take me and go to a meeting. And I got better, you know. And after a year living in a recovery home, they said, well, you could be a power of example, you know, and we're going to give you your own place to run, you know. So they did. They gave me a house in the East End, 297 Willow Avenue, and they signed me to a one-year contract, and my function was staff representative, what the requirements were, that you live with another 6 recovering addicts, alcoholic, and that you be a power of example. And what they mainly asked you was to go to 3 meetings per week, minimum, to have in-house meeting, to keep a curfew, and share your experience, strength, and hope, you know. And I went for it. I said, okay. So here was a 45-year-old man that had to come home at 1 o'clock every night, that had to say, well, I'm going away to visit my brother or my sister or my son or my grandchildren. And, you know, and it was okay. You know, I'm going away for the weekend. Where are you going to be? Well, I'm going to be in my brother's place. Here's the phone number. I'm going up the Blind River to get my little boy. Well, where are you? Okay, here's the phone number. And I did that. I did that because I knew that if I wanted to get better, I had to do everything that they asked me. And I did that. And I lived in those places for 2 years. And I'm really, really grateful, you know, speaking about gratitude. You know, I'm really thankful because that gave me a structure for the first year, you know, of my recovery. And then it gave me a better structure for the second year of my recovery. I actually learned how to become willing, become honest, and become open-minded, because I had to live with another 6 recovering addicts, and it got better. After the 2 years, I decided that, you know what, that I like working in the field, you know. I worked the steps. Tony mentioned that we were in a step study, and I realized that, you know what, I was an insane person when I came into these rooms. And when I looked at step 2, and when I started to understand step 2, I knew that God could restore me to my sanity. I knew that a power greater than myself could restore me to my sanity, because I had that willingness. I had the willingness to change, you know. And I had to change everything. I had to change my behavior. I had to change my habits. I had to change people, places, and things. And that was very, very tough for me to do, people, places, and things. Because I've known those people, places, and things for 30 years. There's nothing else that I knew better. I fit it right in. But you know what? I had to start to change those people, places, and things, you know. And it got better, you know. And today I still see some of those people, places, and things. But it's okay. You know, it's all right. I respect them. and they respect me for what I'm doing today. You know? And you know what? It's all over the city of Toronto that I'm recovering, that I'm an addict. It's all over that I haven't picked up any drugs for 4 years. You know, and they're okay with that. You know, and I'm okay with what they're doing too, because there's hope for everyone. You know? I decided to go back to school, and that makes me feel good when I say that. You know, it really does, and I'm really, really grateful for the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. You know, because I wouldn't be able to do anything, you know, if it wasn't for these rooms. And I did. I went back to school, and I just finished my second semester. And I need one more social science, major social science credit to get my grade 12, my OSSD, which is Ontario Secondary School diploma. And talk about gratitude, you know. I slept in places like the Seton House. I slept in places like Mill Haven Institution. I slept in Joyceville Penitentiary. I slept in Kingston, the Don, the West, a few places out in the West Coast. I could go on and on and on, but that's yesterday. I didn't have to worry about yesterday. I shut the door on that. You know, I just have to keep remembering that that's where I came from. But it's not like that for me today. You know, today it's about recovery. Today is about bettering myself. Today is about going to school. Today is about staying active in my home group. And I am very active, you know. I just, because I had too much on my plate, I just stepped down from GSR of the Road to Recovery. Today, I'm grateful because you probably noticed a little six-year-old running around here, Joey, and I'm really grateful to God that He's put my son back into my life. You know, a few years back, in my insanity, I had thoughts of killing myself, his mother, and the boy. You know, and I used to tell her that. You know, I said, "I'm going to dump you. I'm going to dump myself, and I'm going to dump the kid." You know, and I'm very shameful, you know, of those thoughts. I'm very shameful of those thoughts today. But I know that on the same token, I must talk about stuff like that, you know, because I want to cleanse myself. It'll make me feel good, you know. And today, God is so great in my life that things have changed immensely, you know. I'm very good friends with his mother, you know. And she was cautious at first, but you know what? I had him for the whole summer, you know. So talking about changes, you know, I feel the change. And at the same time, I know that other people feel the change and see the change in me, you know. He's my pride and joy, you know. Tony was telling me that he makes me feel young. Yeah, he does. He makes me feel young. I'm 49 years old. I got a birthday coming up Tuesday. I'm going to turn 50. And I've got a six-year-old boy out there that keeps me pretty active, you know. And we're going to have a lot of fun this summer, you know. We planned out all the camping trips that we're going to do. And I go to the YMCA with him in the morning, and we work out together. He goes swimming with me, and we go to see Batman. And he comes to the meetings with me. He knows my friends. He tells people that Dad doesn't do drugs anymore. He doesn't even drink. He tells people that Dad was very, very sick one time. He says, "Remember that time that you were sick and you went to the hospital and then you went to jail after that?" Well, he knows, you know, that that's not the case today. And I have a lot of gratitude for that, you know. Today I work in a transition house called Ozenham House. And it's run by the same society that took me in when I had 35 days clean. And people like you and I come there right after detoxes, or right after jail, or right after running around the streets with nowhere to go. And it's a stepping stone, you know, to go to treatment. And they can live in this place for up to 8 weeks, you know. We try to get them placed in treatments, and it all depends on how busy the treatment centers are. But It's part of my gratitude, you know, because I give back, you know. I like to talk to them young guys because I see me in them, you know, 25, 30 years ago. I like talking to the middle-aged guys too because that's me today. I don't have no problem with that at all, you know. And I like to talk to the ones that are older than me because I know that there's a lot of hope, you know. There's a lot of hope. I was the type of guy that I thought that this thing would never work, you know. But what did I know, you know? What did I know? Well, there it is. That's an example of my happiness today. That's an example of my gratitude today, you know. You know, God does wonderful things in my life today, you know, and you've all seen it, you know. I live for that, you know. And I know that if I want to keep that, all I got to do is not pick up on a daily basis, you know. I'm grateful to my sponsor, and all I got to do is pick up the phone and talk to my sponsor. And it doesn't have to be just when I'm hurting or in trouble or whatever. Pick up the phone and say, hi, how you doing? Are you having a good day? I'm having a great day. I'm having a shitty day. And I do that, you know. Because of school, I didn't really spend that much time with him as I used to. Because I put, you know, he's got a life as well. And he works, you know, and there's things that he must do. But I always pick up the phone. And I know that if I want to see him during the week, all I have to do is go to a meeting at 10:30 in the morning on Tuesday, and he's always there. And I've done that. I've taken a half hour off of school, you know, during my break period, just to go down and say hi. Hi, how are you? Give me a hug. I can't stay. I'm on lunch. I got to run. Okay, you know. Those are the new things, you know. Those are the new things. I'm going to go to George Brown, and I'm going to take a two-year course. Those are my plans. And I don't know where it's going. I really don't know where it's going, but it's going to be okay, you know. My faith tells me that, you know what, as long as I do what I want to do and I take good, good orderly direction, you know, and God gives me that. He gives me good orderly direction every day because I get on my knees first thing in the morning as soon as I get out of bed. I don't have a problem with that. I get on my knees, and I keep it very simple, and I ask for strength and hope, and I ask him to guide me, you know, to give me that strength, you know, because my way of thinking sometimes, it might take a left turn, you know, instead of taking a right, it might go left, and I don't want that to happen, you know, and God's been good to me, you know, he's put so much back in my life, you know. I had a son. I have a 29-year-old son that I was in denial. You know, I had seen him a few times. His mother brought him to the penitentiary when he was 10 years old, and I've made amends. You know, and I've got to know him, and we're really, really close. You know, we're the best of friends. You know, today I do whatever I can, and he loves me, and he tells me that, and I feel the same way, and I tell him. You know, I have beautiful three grandchildren. You know. And I see them on a weekly basis. I spend a lot of time with them, you know. And I'm grateful for that.
For the conclusion of this presentation, please turn your cassette over and depress the play button. Do not rewind your cassette.